Today I have with me Ben Steer and Trey Adcock, and we are going to talk about resiliency, especially related to Indigenous people. Ben is a professor of anthropology at Western Carolina University and teaches in the Cherokee Studies program. Ben, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, thanks so much for having me and Trey on this morning. So yeah, I'm actually an archaeologist by training. So just to be clear about some identity stuff, I'm not Indigenous, not a Cherokee person. I have been working on collaborative archaeological research projects with the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians since about 2011. And then even before that, worked as an archaeological field technician, sometimes affectionately called shovel bums, projects here in the mountains of North Carolina in my early 20s before graduate school. So and working at Western Carolina for the last 7 years, I've had the really great experience. Sometimes when you join the faculty of a university, you you inherit classes, right, from other departments and programs. And so I sort of inherited these classes in teaching about Indigenous cultures and in Cherokee culture in particular. So my research and my scholarship in a lot of ways over the last 7 years shifted not strictly from archaeology, but also toward Indigenous studies, learning more about Cherokee language, Cherokee culture, for example. So that's become an increasingly important part of my work. And that's also how I met my friend Trey, sort of through that Cherokee Studies program.
So Trey, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'm an associate professor at UNC Asheville. This is my 11th year. It's my 20th year in the classroom. I started in a public schools as a social studies teacher. I am a Cherokee Nation citizen, so my family was displaced from North Georgia and North Alabama. My mom, my grandfather, my great-grandparents are all from Oklahoma. And it informed my professional life. I went to go get a PhD at Chapel Hill. I was a public school teacher, taught social studies, and my PhD is in education. So when I came to UNC Asheville, I was in the education department. But when I arrived at UNC Asheville, there was no curriculum, really. I mean, one or two classes maybe regarding Native people. At the time, we didn't have any Eastern Band Cherokee Indian students on campus. And so, professionally, it was something I was interested in. And my dissertation was out at Sequoia Schools in Oklahoma, which is Cherokee Nation boarding school. And so professionally, I had this interest, but also personally, I felt a responsibility to work on these issues and to work with the community. And really, that's what I've tried to do over the last 11 years. I do want to say, really, a lot of my work now is as the executive director for the Center for Native Help, which is a small nonprofit in Whittier. And all of that work is grassroots, community-based work, working with Indigenous populations. Yeah, thanks for having us, and I'm looking forward to the convo.
So leading up to the show, one of the things we've kind of been talking about was why we might even have this conversation. And one of the things we talked about was throughout history, Indigenous people and the Cherokee have been taking on the challenges we see today. It could be related to health and wellness. It could be related to the environment. What are some of the examples you guys think about, the challenges that we face overall in society with perhaps what we can learn from Cherokee or Indigenous people?
Yeah, Trey, I can start and then kind of hand it off to you. Maybe we could start with health and wellness, right?
Okay.
Especially given your interest with the Center for Native Health. And so I guess I'll start by sort of telling a story. My first year at Western Carolina, I was having a hallway conversation with Tom Belt. And Tom Belt is a fluent Cherokee language speaker. He's now retired from Western, but he taught Cherokee language at our university for a long time. And he was telling me about the Cherokee concept of Tohi. And Tohi is a really holistic Indigenous philosophy, if you want to say that, on health and wellness. And, Tom was talking to me about Tohi and phrasing it and thinking about it in terms of balance, being in balance, not being overly obsessed with any one part of your life. And boy, as a young academic worried about tenure with young kids and stuff, that really hit me, right? That idea of not being overly obsessed about maybe, say, your career, or overly obsessed about one particular part of your life. That notion of balance, while it's rooted in a very specific Cherokee cultural context, I think that's certainly, there's all this interest in mindfulness, right? And people are putting mindfulness apps on their phones,
right.
Here's an Indigenous concept grounded in space and place here that I think is sort of broadly applicable. Trey, you want to maybe pick up?
I think, yeah, Tohi is sort of a central rooting philosophy in a sense. And I mean, I think on the surface, yeah, I mean, I think balance is an appropriate way to talk about that. Yeah, it's a guiding principle in some ways. I think, at the Center for Native Health, Tohi is a guiding thought for us as we take on projects and we think about who we want to be as an organization. I think about it also in regards to this idea of historical trauma. How do we heal from a legacy of colonization. And some of that is restoring ourselves to who we were, who we are, and who, I think looking to the future and who we want to be. And I think Tohi is just a guiding idea for how we see ourselves and we see ourselves as an organization. And I think how we as individuals fit within this larger concept of community.
Are there other examples you can give related to other issues?
For the Center for Native Health, one of our projects right now, we're working with the Eastern Band Natural Resources, working to develop cultural protocols around land management and conservation. Mm-hmm. So somebody might say to me, well, what does that have to do with health? For us, it has everything to do with health. When you take a group of people and you indigenous people particularly, and you uproot them from a particular place, you're rupturing the umbilical cord. You're disrupting not just the surface level of where they live. I mean, you're disrupting what it means to be that thing in a sense. So, you know, for Cherokee people, we're deeply rooted in this landscape through the concept of place. Mm-hmm. Even I think it's worth saying, you know, that most people know us as Cherokee. I mean, that's not actually our name in the language. It's Gadua.
Okay.
And so I know a lot of folks that refer to themselves as Ani Gaduwa Gi. We could spend a lot of time breaking that down, but basically it means people of this dirt or a particular place. What emanates from that place is language and dance and song, identity, responsibilities, kinship, all of these different things. So when we talk about removal and historical trauma, it disrupted all of that. And so I think, you know, whether we're talking about environment or we're talking about type 2 diabetes or we're talking about drug and alcohol or teen pregnancy or we're talking about casino gambling, I mean, any of these things, to me, it all sort of emanates from this conversation around place and Tohi.
We haven't really talked about the implications that require Tohi.
I think it's important to say that, you know, the disruption or, you know, whatever, I mean, it was forced removal. It was government policy, part of this longer policy of extermination, right? Trauma gets rooted. I mean, there's lots of research that says, you know, trauma gets rooted in your body. Michael Yellowbird talks about trauma getting rooted in your brain. And that is passed from generation to generation to generation. And so, I you know, for me, at the Center for Native Health, it's really a conversation about, you know, what are the projects, what are the activities we want to embark on and support that contribute to this idea, not just of individual health, which is important, but I think for indigenous populations, you know, also alongside that, what contributes to community health? Land is a part of that. I mean, we have a project where we're working with some Cherokee potters to protect, preserve, revitalize, whatever language we want to use around traditional Cherokee pottery. And someone would say to me, well, why is that health? Well, to me, again, of course it's health. I mean, you know, it's rooted in place. I'm trying to find these places to dig clay, relearning and teaching younger Cherokee potters about thousands of years of this tradition. You know, to me, this is all about restoring this sense of balance and tohi to combat 500 years of colonization of all of these things.
And yeah, to build on Trey's idea that about these relationships between culture and environment and health, I would point folks to the work of the really excellent Cherokee Nation scholar, Melissa Lewis. She teaches in the medical school at the University of Minnesota. And a lot of her research is centered around the idea of culture as prevention, culture as treatment. I mean, we have that broad idea of like prevention is the best medicine, right? Like ideally. And her work focuses on how culture specifically is part of preventative medicine, part of preventative health. And so some examples, one thing that she's big into is foraging traditional Cherokee foods, and in particular, like when they're in season. And what her research has shown, and Melissa does such a great job of combining this kind of like quantitative, you know, Western scientific approach along with indigenous knowledge. And, you know, she's got some really great research showing that traditional, I'm using traditional kind of in quotes here, right? But sort of, you know, Cherokee diets that maybe we can look back as far as this, you know, 17th, 16th, 15th century, people are eating foods as they come in season, right when your body needs those vitamins, right? So that's things like greens that are coming into season in the early spring after you're kind of coming out of winter, right? And you're like kind of starved for vitamin E and vitamin E, right? Berries coming into season in the summer when viral loads can be higher sometimes, and they've got these antioxidants and things that boost your immune system, right? So by going outside, gathering these foods, which reinforces that relationship with landscape and with place, you're also, for sort of like speaking like a dietitian here, right? Like getting the precise vitamins that your body needs at a time. So it's this integrative model, you know, where culture, landscape, biological health kind of converge. And if those things are in balance, that's like a really healthy way to live.
How would you guys characterize progress? I mean, you're talking about Tohi and teaching and healing. How's it going?
That is a really big question. I mean, I think these things are complicated. I mean, it's probably the word in my classroom I use all the time. I mean, these things are just complicated.
Right.
And so I think you see a lot of signs of health. I mean, I really do. I mean, I think it's important to look at those things. I mean, you look at, you know, economic determinism. You look at the infrastructure building of a lot of tribal nations. You look at educational attainment. A lot of those trends that were in the past pointed downwards are now pointed upwards. I think that's important to look at. And I think, to be honest, as we head into climate change, I think you have a lot of these tribal nations that will be leaders in these movements. I could just see it at UNC Asheville, the amount of interest from our students and our faculty and our staff, really kind of across the board as it relates to indigenous issues. I don't know that was the case when I first got to UNC Asheville. I mean, maybe it was, and I just wasn't aware of it. But I think the word progress is a little tricky for us.
Yeah.
But I do think there are a lot of positive things to think about and that are happening.
Do you think Americans are learning from indigenous people and applying anything they've learned?
That's a great question. Where do we start? I think there are some, as Trey mentioned, some sort of, you know, signs of progress. But to be honest, I think most Americans don't really know much about indigenous culture. I mean, think about sort of your standard high school curriculum, and I'll use myself as an example. So I'm 41. I grew up in Durham, North Carolina. Durham had pretty good public schools, actually. And I think my memory of learning about Cherokee culture was like the one page in my North Carolina eighth grade history class that, you know, mentioned removal on a page and had one sad watercolor picture of the Trail of Tears. And that was like the extent of my knowledge. And I think there's been some progress from, you know, since then. But as a, you know, professor at Western Carolina, I get so many students who are just hungry to learn about indigenous cultures because they understand that they really haven't learned much. And so while I think there is an increased interest, there's still a long way to go. I think a lot of people's understanding about indigenous culture still largely comes from kind of popular culture and popular media and Hollywood. And there's a lot of stereotypes that develop from that. You know, one thing I've told my students before is like, I don't think many folks watch Apollo 13 and think they could go to the moon, but I've seen a lot of folks that have watched Dances with Wolves one time and think they know something about indigenous culture. And so I think that while there certainly has been progress, particularly in a lot of ways, at least in the circles that I'm in, you know, certain parts of the academy have been doing a better job of really listening to indigenous people and taking indigenous knowledge seriously. But I think there's still a tremendous need for education.
Yeah, and Ben and I had the great pleasure at different point of listening to Cherokee Nation scholar, has a really popular podcast called This Land. Her name is Rebecca Nagel. And she talks about how this idea of education and really what the general population doesn't know about Native people, for all the reasons I think Ben just talked about, how that also permeates into the Supreme Court. You know, the justices don't know about Native people, and they're making some pretty important decisions as it relates to tribal nations.
Can you elaborate on that?
It's a case about Indian Child Welfare Act, Brackeen versus Hallin. What's at stake on the surface is the protection of Native children. But deeper than that is really a question of the status of tribal nations in the United States, sovereignty itself. And it's really, really dangerous. Part of what makes it really dangerous is that the even the questions that the justices are considering and thinking about are so rooted in misconcepts and stereotypes and just a general lack of knowledge about American Indian history, about sovereignty.
A lot of people just really don't understand tribal nations and tribal sovereignty. So there's 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States and Alaska, you know, as of today. And those 574 federally recognized tribes, those are political groups. If you're a citizen in one of those tribes, then you have rights of citizenship in that group. And people don't seem to have too much trouble understanding the idea of like someone having dual Canadian U.S. citizenship, for example. But, you know, if you're an indigenous person in one of these nations, then you have that dual citizenship. And those tribal nations are sovereign nations. So this is a little bit oversimplified, but, you know, you should think about them as being another sovereign nation like Italy. or something, right? You know, and think about people having, you know, dual citizenship. And again, the fact that those kind of basic concepts about sovereignty are not broadly understood, as Trey has pointed out, I mean, that has really dire implications for people.
I teach about this in my class, and I think it's a concept that really is the foundation, unfortunately, of federal Indian law, property rights, and it's referred to as the Doctrine of Discovery. And the Doctrine of Discovery was a series of papal bulls in the 15th, 16th century based in Roman law, and it really was sort of the legal justification for the claiming of indigenous lands, not just here in the U.S., but throughout the world, all throughout Africa and in the South. And I mean, some of it is really based on who is Christian and who is not. The principles that are in that doctrine of discovery, and again, it's not just one document, it's not like a handbook, it's a series of rulings by the church at the time that come to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery. It gets brought into U.S. law in three court cases in the 19th century called the Marshall Trilogy. The last one of those cases, the Cherokee Nation, we actually win that daggum court case, and we're still removed along with other Southeastern peoples. But fundamental to the Doctrine of Discovery is this idea that Native people only have the right of occupancy, the same as a tree, a bird, you know, whatever. European powers and their descendants have the right of ownership. And that fundamentally permeates all aspects of federal Indian law. So much so in 2005, RBG, I love RBG. I'm just saying that this is the complicated part of people's histories. In 2005, in a ruling with the United Nations, in the footnote, when they ruled against the United Nations, UNIDA, RBG used the specific term Doctrine of Discovery. So this is 500 and some odd years later. It is still
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes. Yeah. It's being referenced as a weapon against an indigenous tribal nation.
Do you think she even knew what that meant?
I don't know. I can't really speak for her. And to be honest, there are lots of Native people that are way more versed mm-hmm. in federal Indian law than I am, you know, and they might have a different opinion about that. I think it just highlights the complete lack of historical knowledge and just education. There was a court case in 2019. It's called McGirt. RBG was still on the bench at that time, and I my understanding is that for a lot of people, you know, they were concerned about what that swing vote would be, and it was, you know, Gorsuch. So a lot of people, at least in my class, mm-hmm. a lot of people that tend to be Democrats assume Native people are Democrats, and it's way more complicated than that. And so Gorsuch, which is a Republican justice, I mean, he's probably the most fluent in federal Indian law because he served out in Oklahoma, and so he experienced it. And so his ruling in that case is pretty profound. And so I know a lot of Native activists that were excited that he got on the bench because he's fluent federal Indian law, and the bench needs that.
That goes to show how important it is for people to be exposed and to learn and to, you know, just try to understand.
So what are some of the complicating factors that...
Well, I mean, not to sound like a broken record, but again, I'm going to come back around to sovereignty, you know, and this need to respect sovereignty. So I think I'll once again sort of amplify the voice of another really, really excellent Cherokee Nation scholar. And in this case, I'll refer folks to work by Courtney Lewis. Courtney Lewis is actually Melissa Lewis's sister, and she teaches at Duke. She's got a great book called Sovereign Entrepreneurs, Cherokee Small Business Owners and the Making of Economic Sovereignty. And that's a really excellent book. It's an ethnography in some ways of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in Cherokee, North Carolina, sort of through a lens of doing interviews and participant observation with small business owners. One of the many things that comes out of Courtney Lewis's work that even as the Eastern Band has been able to bolster their economic sovereignty, so control over access to the means of making a living, they still have to fight really hard for political sovereignty, to have their sovereignty as a tribe recognized, even when there are laws on the books. And that's been a recurring theme in the history of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians for many, many years. I mean, something that a lot of folks sort of don't know is that after the Treaty of New Echota in 1835, folks are removed to Oklahoma, but there is a core group of Cherokee who remain here in North Carolina. And that core group becomes the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. It's not just a matter of sort of like hiding in the woods. That's kind of oversimplified many times. But really, as early as 1817 and 1819, a lot of Eastern Band folks, I use the term sometimes with my students, start to lawyer up and really fight for their rights to stay here. In the 19th century, they actually take advantage of some loopholes in tax laws to incorporate as a charter and actually incorporate as the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians corporation, essentially, and use business laws that are stronger than civil rights laws at that time to protect their sovereignty. Just that long history of having to fight for political sovereignty, I think, has to maintain at the, you know, sort of at the foreground in these discussions.
What are some other complications to the economic growth and prosperity of indigenous people?
Sovereignty is like the answer for all things.
Yeah.
Land rights and territorial rights are really important. And again, I mean, the indigenous experience is so diverse. It just it also depends geographically, you know, where you're at. I mean, when we look at tribal gaming, there's this, I think, at least a lot of my students will come into the class thinking that, oh, if a tribe has a casino, therefore they're wealthy. That's just not what the data shows. I mean, it's the minority of tribal gaming that actually profits from that. And so you have a few tribes that are making a good amount of money. You have a lot of tribes that are still, you know, it goes back in some ways to Tohi, both the health internally, but also, you know, being able to protect those boundaries, and goes to the political system and protecting tribal sovereignty. So, I mean, I think this idea of sovereignty is not set in stone. I mean, I think Ben alluded to this, that it is an everyday struggle and fight to protect the right to govern yourself, to protect your boundaries, and to develop yourself as a tribal nation. And again, I think it's such a diverse experience in the indigenous world that, you know, it's in some ways, it's just super complicated.
In the 19th century, Eastern Cherokee, beginning around 1817 and 19, in some treaties with the state of North Carolina, are able to sort of negotiate, a historian John Finger called a kind of anomalous citizenship status, where they're not quite federal, don't quite have federal status, not quite state citizens, but are able to kind of maintain this kind of citizenship. And these folks work together, and they also later work with the help of some white, you know, lawyers and businessmen, to, in particular, William Holland Thomas, to buy up contiguous tracts of land. And it's that actual purchasing of their own land, and we can talk about how messed up that is if you want, right? There's sort of this dark humor about, you know, having to buy their own land back two or three times, you know, but buying up these contiguous blocks of land, and then politically fighting the 19th century process of allotment. And this is another really big issue in Native American studies and history here, is this late 19th century process by which tribal lands that were owned, not really communally, that's not the right word, but sort of, you know, owned as a whole by tribes, were broken up into these small units. And that was part of what was sometimes called the quote, scare quote, civilization policy, you know, to try and convert indigenous peoples into essentially sort of like white yeoman farmers. But, you know, the Eastern Band really continually fought that process of allotment, which is why we still have a Qualla boundary today. And so it was continue, you know, collective political action, you know, pushing back against.
I'm going to interrupt when I hear words I'm not familiar with. What's Qualla boundary?
Oh, the Qualla boundary is the federal trust land of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. So that's more commonly called the Cherokee Reservation.
Oh, okay.
But it's not, strictly speaking, a reservation in that same sense.
Yeah,
so the Qualla boundary.
Yeah, I mean, when you were asking the question about land, I mean, there are different types of, at least in the U.S., you know, like different classifications for tribal lands. How they were set up is different for all tribes. So again, it's just incredibly, incredibly complicated. Your question about how tribes and tribal citizens are becoming able to affect change. You know, I just would say that, like, you know, if you look at the Eastern Band, the number of degrees that have been achieved, I mean, has, I don't know. I don't want to say doubled or tripled. I don't know the exact number, but the number of educated citizens continues to grow. I think that's something that we have to really kind of to look at and take into account. I mean, I think
education is one of the things that we have, like, as a foundation in this show, to talk about how important education is on so many aspects, between, you know, being able to have economic promise, to be able to take better care of the environment, just to impact so many other things.
Where do we go next? What would you advocate for in terms of helping our listeners understand how they can think more about the plight of indigenous people and how to think about supporting them and encouraging part of our population?
Yeah, so I'll start with something really local that I think can be a model for, you know, maybe other institutions. But at Western Carolina, for over 10 years now, we've had a really great symposium every September called the Rooted in the Mountains Symposium, which was developed by Dr. Lisa Leffler, who teaches in our culturally based Native Health Program at Western Carolina, good friend and colleague, and also Tom Belt. At Rooted in the Mountains, every September, Western brings together indigenous scholars, scholars, Cherokee cultural experts, and what you might think of as more like sort of traditional Western scholars, doctors, PhDs, to come and talk about issues related to health and wellness and environment. So we've had whole symposium dedicated to, for example, water quality. So indigenous perspectives on water management and improving water quality. Our most recent one was about mental health. So indigenous perspectives on mental health, and there's something really special about the symposium where, I mean, even just visually at the table, you know, on the podium in front of the audience there, you have Cherokee fluent speakers with ethnobotanical knowledge, and they're coming as ethnobotanical experts, people who have, you know, knowledge about plants and how they help with wellness, sitting quite literally next to PhDs in biology and sort of having these collaborative conversations. So I think a really important thing to do, and Root in the Mountains would be one example of this, is that we take indigenous knowledge seriously, that we don't just think about indigenous culture as interesting or something that like checks a diversity box, but is really an important source of practical knowledge, local knowledge. And just to give one more example before I hand it off to Trey, there's so much interesting stuff happening in natural resource management, landscape, scale problems. I'm sure, you know, everybody in the room here is familiar with the increasing frequency and intensity of wildfires in the American West, but even here locally. And part of that is decades of, you know, the U.S. Forest Service practice of fire suppression that led to a huge buildup of tinder, essentially. But it goes back farther than that, which is to say that all the landscapes in America were the product of stewardship by indigenous people before Europeans arrived. You read these early historic accounts of people coming through North Carolina, like William Bartram in 1775, and he's seeing orchards and fields and forests that had been cleared by controlled burn, such that you can ride your horse at a gallop through like these big understories, you know, or open understories. And so there is this incredibly important indigenous knowledge about how to manage landscapes that is going to be crucial for how we adapt to climate change and how we, you know, push back against, you know, wildfires that are increasingly threatening health, not just in terms of your house burning down, but in terms of things like respiratory health as well. So taking indigenous knowledge seriously, understanding this local knowledge about landscape and ecosystem that remarkably, thanks to the resilience of indigenous people, is still there and is absolutely just as relevant in 2022 as it was in 1492.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been said. I mean, you know, I just find it sometimes interesting how knowledge systems are repackaged, rebranded, and sold back to us. Something like sustainability. I don't know that we call this sustainability. We just were living lives, you know? And so I think those knowledge systems will continue to persist and be important. But in terms of this question of what can we do, or, I mean, and this goes to, I think, the question I was trying to answer earlier, is I think that, you know, you look at how a lot of indigenous people have used modern technologies and sort of adjusted them to fit their own needs, and not just consuming digital technologies, but also using them sort of to speak back to these stereotypes and this lack of knowledge. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for people to learn about indigenous populations because of these digital technologies, whether it be Facebook or Instagram, or, you know, a lot of tribal nations have their own web pages where they're telling their stories. And so, you know, for my students, I'm like, there's really no excuse at this point, you know? I mean, and every semester, you know, I require them to attend a cultural event, and I'll start off with no cultural events that I know of. And by the end of the semester, there's like 15 to 20. And this is a really rich area for things to participate and get engaged with. And I think, you know, to be honest, if you look in Asheville, I mean, the Indigenous Walls Project, yeah, I think has highlighted the diversity and the richness of indigenous life within the city. So I think there's a real opportunity for people to go out and learn. I mean, every October, one of my favorite times of the year in Western North Carolina is the Cherokee Fair, which is for a week. I mean, if you really want to know that community, go to a stickball game out in the community, you know.
There's a lot to learn. And we should really seek out how to learn about indigenous people, the plight, and some of these solutions. Trey, Ben, thanks for coming in. And everybody out there, enjoy your day.